Good morning, everybody. My name is Tim Porter. I'm one of the pastors here for Faith Community. Thank you for being here. And as we begin, I just want to go on record as to say, if my wife is planning my funeral, I want "Great Is Our Faithfulness" sung at my funeral. I hear my grandmother singing whenever we sing that song together, and I want to pass that song on. So, just a powerful song of God's faithfulness. Hi, I'm starting off talking about funerals. Welcome and hope. There we go. Hey, I just want to let you know that I'm just really grateful that you are here this morning and that you're making Sunday morning worship a priority for your life. Thank you for doing whatever it took to get here this morning. Also, I want you to know that right after the service, I'll be available to answer any questions you might have about anything I said in this sermon, in this teaching time, or if you're wondering, how do I apply this right here, right now, in my circumstances? I'll have about 25 minutes after the service. I'd love to talk with you and answer any questions you might have. When I was a young boy, a very young boy, I went with my grandparents to visit my uncle and his family in Kankakee, Illinois. We spent the weekend with them regularly, and so that was nothing new. But one thing was new that weekend that we spent with my relatives, and that was on Saturday night, we had ordered carryout, and my uncle asked me to go with him to pick up the pizza and the pasta and those types of things that we had ordered. And we went out in the garage, and I sat down in his, it's probably 80s, early 80s, 308 cherry red Ferrari. And in that moment, those circumstances awakened in me a desire that I did not know that I had. In that moment, I wanted to be rich. I was very young, and I knew what I wanted. I wanted to be wealthy, and I had no idea how dangerous that desire is and was. No one warned me about that desire, and it has actually taken me decades to understand my own heart and how actually deep-seated that desire to be wealthy is in my own heart and the hearts of my friends and neighbors and relatives around me. Because the desire to be wealthy, the desire to be rich, is actually not so much about the money. It's about the hope. The hope that wealth offers. About deep desires in our heart that we believe will be satisfied if I had more. So we're in a series on hope, and we're all hope-based creatures. We all live by hope. You have hopes today about what this day is going to be like. You have hopes for this week and what this week will be like. You have hopes for this year and what this year will be like and what you're hoping it will be. And today we want to talk about one of the closest competitors in this world to actually realizing the hopes that our hearts are made for but won't deliver. We're going to talk a little bit about money and wealth. Because we all have deep desires for a perfect world with a perfect relationships, but money will not give it. Money is actually a trap to those desires. So we're looking at 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 10, and also verses 17 through 19. It's found in the Bibles in front of you on pages 9, 93, and 94. We're looking at, again, 1 Timothy 6, and we're going to look at these three headings from this passage: glad generosity, escaping the snare of money, with our hope set on the rich provider. Glad generosity, the snare of money, and rich provider. Again, 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 10, and then 17 through 19. A little context before we read this passage together. Paul is the author of this letter that we're reading, and he's writing to his understudy and co-worker in the gospel, in the ministry, a man named Timothy. And he's talking to Timothy about how to lead a church to help the church grow to become mature and reproducing. And he's warning Timothy about people who enter into church leadership hoping that they are going to gain money and riches by entering into leadership. And as he does so, Paul teaches some important things that we all need to know about regarding money and what we actually put our hope in and what we live for. So he writes, "But godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into a temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs." And down to verse 17, "As for the rich in this present age, the majority of us in this room, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasures for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, I'm really grateful for our passage today because it is actually one of the most clear passages on money and the heart that the Bible offers. Clear teaching on what our lives could be like. It's actually clear teaching as well on what our lives could be like if we were to set our hope in God and the force for good that we could be in the world if we set our hopes on God and used our resources to do as much good as we possibly can do. And I want to start from this passage, even though this passage has a warning in it, I want to start with the positive in this passage, you know, because I'm such a positive guy. I started out talking about my funeral, right? This passage actually blends together two really important concepts, real important realities about who God is and how he's made us. It talks about a glad generosity. A glad generosity. Now, though I said that love for money is a snare, it's a trap, it's dangerous, it may surprise you to know that actually the Bible has really positive things to say about wealth and money. The Bible starts with an all-powerful, good, generous God that creates a world for fruitfulness and for flourishing, or for what we might call today productivity and opportunity and wealth. Tom Nelson, in his book, The Economics of Neighborly Love, very good book, writes this: "Think about it. We take sand and we make computer chips. We take trees and we make furniture and paper. Whether the value that we create with our time and energy is monetized or not, we create wealth in the world. A wealthy and generous God designed us with this in mind. We're supposed to make wealth. Just consider how God has made plants. How has God designed the stalk of wheat? Think about how many seeds are in that stalk. Depending on the environment, environmental conditions, you can get up to 120 to 200 seeds from just one stalk of wheat. What does that tell us about God? God is woven into creation the idea of flourishing, or the principle of flourishing and abundance and reproducing wealth. God made the world with wealth and abundance in mind. Key figures in the Old Testament, extremely wealthy. Abraham, Job, though he lost everything for a while, he got everything back and even more. David, Solomon, his son. In the New Testament, there's Lydia, who is a businesswoman who helped fund the mission of the early church. Philemon, or you might call him Philemon. I've got a good friend named Philemon, so I promised that I'd always call that name Philemon instead of Philemon. But Philemon has a letter written to him by Paul, and he housed the church, a wealthy man. And Paul, in verse 17, he reinstates, he rearticulates that the Bible's view of wealth is that God richly provides us with all things, everything to enjoy, wealth, and the joys that come with it are God's gifts, God's idea. It's all. Everything that we enjoy is a gift from him. And I know we say that, but do we rejoice and enjoy the God who gives us these things? It's a gift from him. How is it all a gift from him? You might be saying, no, I worked hard for what I have. Yeah, great. Who gave you the energy to do that? God created the raw materials that we creatively draw the potential out of for helping one another flourish and for the wealth and creation that allows us to have enjoyment because of the physical strength that we have, the ingenuity, the creativity, the courage, the determination. It's all given by God. Everything is a gift. He's made all things, and he holds all things together until he renews all things. But this passage not only talks about how we're given all kinds of things, everything in our lives for our enjoyment from a good, gracious, generous, wealthy God. This passage also calls us, verse 18, you can see it there. Paul says, the rich, we are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share. The Bible talks about a glad generosity that you and I can experience, enjoying everything that we've been given, while at the same time seeking to be as generous as we possibly can be and do as much good as we possibly can do with our wealth. I grew up in the church, and though I grew up in the church, quite frankly, I had a pretty poor view of generosity. It was pitched more to me as an obligation and as a duty. Growing up, we called it tithing, and we still use that word here at Faith Community. Kevin just used it. And tithing is a loan word from the Old Testament, and what tithing talks about is giving the first 10% of your gross income, whatever the first fruits of your income is, giving that first fruits, that 10% to the Lord and dedicating it to him. It's a biblical concept, like I said, and we practice that here at Faith Community. It would be great. We would love everybody to get to the place where they could give 10% of their gross income to the mission of Faith Community Church. So we can work toward. But we also talk about, if you heard Kevin say it, our offering time is a time to give our tithes and our offerings. And offerings are gifts of generosity that we give above and beyond the 10% that we set aside to God and the mission of the church. This would be for anything above and beyond the 10%, anything you might give to a parachurch ministry, anything you might give to the church that's above and beyond our regular 10%, for the building fund, for Vision for the Valley. So the offerings are. Now, like I said, I used to think that this was like an obligation, and there's some obligation to it. I mean, if you become a member of Faith Community, we're committing that this is what we're going to grow toward. We're going to seek to pool our money together and give 10% of our gross income to the mission of the church. But the Bible's view of generosity is far superior than just duty and obligation. It's to invest our resources to do as much good as we possibly can do. Not just to reinvest our financial wealth into companies or stocks or to funds to help build our own wealth. It's to invest in the mission of the local church for fruitful work to help people be transformed by the gospel. To do as much good as we possibly can do with the money that we have been given. It's to help people be transformed by the gospel, neighborhoods renewed, and people who are developed to be sent on mission, empowered for ministry around the world. Because the gospel and the church can transform people and do things, do a kind of good that no other business in the world can do. It can transform hearts. Now, that's not to say that work and investing in work is not good. The Bible has a huge, beautiful, robust view of the goodness of work. One of the chief ways in which we love our neighbors is the type of quality of work that we do. Think about Medtronic. Think about Boston Scientific. We're an equal opportunity advertiser for scientific endeavors here at Faith Community. But think about the work that they do, little pacemakers that put into your body that cause your heart to keep going. It's amazing. That's love for neighbor. It's love for neighbor. But Boston Scientific and Medtronic, as great as they are with electronical devices and helping the human heart go on, it can't transform a heart. Only gospel can do that. So we want to diversify our good, the good that we can do, through not only investing in corporations and work, but also in generosity and doing things that businesses can't do to seek to transform lives. Think about the amount of work that we can do in the St. Croix Valley if we all pooled our resources together to generously supply people for work, or to be transforming with the gospel, to be transforming with the gospel. Now, Faith Community, one of the things that's just amazing about you is that you are wonderfully generous. Thank you. Thank you for seeking to be glad and generous with the things that God has done and given you. And I want to ask you, if you're new to Faith Community, that you would make it a goal to, at some point in time in the future, to work toward giving 10% of your gross income to the mission of Faith Community Church. We're seeking to do a great deal of good. And if you're already doing that, I want to ask you that you would, please seek to increase your offerings. In the next few years, we hope to open up a biblical counseling center. We want to bring biblical counseling into Hudson, into the public, to try to serve our neighbors in significant ways. We want to renew the neighborhoods in the valley. And one of the key ways that we can contribute to the St. Croix Valley in such a way that if we weren't here, the county would have to raise taxes, is by helping people, especially with their relational problems. We have a lot of material wealth in St. Croix County. We have a lot of relational deficit. We can help with that. We can help. Vision for the Valley is coming. Start praying about how you might be able to contribute to helping empower missional leaders around the world to bring the transforming news of the gospel into places, some places that have never heard it. We've got an opportunity. It's awesome. It's amazing. We seek to do much good together as a church. And glad generosity is one of the ways to do that. Now, the Bible's view of money is actually complex. Money is a good thing, as I've said. We can accomplish a lot of good with our money while enjoying what God has given us. It's a very positive message. And at the same time, you read it in the passage, you heard it read, that money is also a snare. It's a trap. There's a danger with money. Money's dangerous. We need to watch out for the snare of money. Now, Paul says in verse 10 that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Now, some people will say, it's just money that's the root of all kinds of evil. No, that's not what the Bible says. Money in and of itself is not a bad thing. It's the love of money. And what he means by that is that in verse 10 that we can trace back so many societal and personal evils back to the craving for more money. And out of a love for money, we can justify all kinds of wickedness. Think of Ponzi schemes. Now, Paul uses a powerful metaphor in this passage to talk about the danger of wealth and seeking to love it and desiring to get more and more and more of it. In verse 9, he says that those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare. And a snare is a type of hunting device. Found out this week they're actually illegal to use in the state of Wisconsin. It's hidden from the prey, and then just at the right moment, this is what a snare does. It's hidden from the prey, and just at the right moment when the prey steps into the trap, boom, snared, you're caught, you're sprung, you're killed, you're eaten, you're done. Money is like that, Paul says. One of the greatest novels written in the 20th century now is put to a film that's talking about the danger of money and wealth is The Hobbit. Thorin Oakenshield, dwarf, is consumed by greed, and he couldn't see it. So that's the thing that's so dangerous about greed and money is we can't see the damage that it's actually doing to us. Other people can see it, but we can't. But the Bible uncovers the trap for us. It's not the simple love for wealth that is the problem. It's not as if we had a room full of $20 bills that were, you know, 20 million $20 bills in a room. It's not like we'd go up and hug it and like, oh, it's so great. I mean, well, maybe you will. But that's not the idea. It's not so much the paper that we love. It's the messages. It's what our hearts are doing and the hopes that we're believing because of the wealth that we have or want. That's where the dangers come in. In verse 9, Paul talks about craving and desires, and what he means is that we take money and wealth, which is a good thing, and we make it this ultimate thing. We take a good thing and we love it too much. And we try to make wealth and money do things for our hearts and for our lives that it isn't intended to do. One of the ways in which we try to make money do too much and love too much is we try to get our security out of it. A heart's security. This is where money is a snare. As we try to answer a desire in our heart for security with money. Paul says, don't do that. When we set our hearts on money for security, we're actually trusting in something that is uncertain. And when we are insecure, you don't want to trust in anything uncertain, but money promises. We even call it securities. It's uncertain, Paul says. He's tapping into a whole stream, a whole line theme of the Bible. Proverbs 23, 4 and 5. Don't wear yourself out to get rich. Don't trust your own cleverness. Cast a glance at riches, and they are gone. They will surely sprout wings and fly off to the sky like an eagle. Just 5 years ago, I was talking to a Christian brother, extremely wealthy. The kind of wealthy where he has three homes, all paid off, three different regions of the United States. Today, he's bankrupt. He's living in an apartment. Just 5 short years. Money is necessary. We can't live without it. But if we seek our security in wealth, we will never actually have contentment that we're made for. We'll never actually experience the security that we're made for. Because money in and of itself is insecure. It's not a secure thing. Also, our heart's sense of security is going to fluctuate with our balance sheet and with the market. Money also traps us in this way because the more money we make, that means the more that we can afford and the more things we actually buy. And the more things we have, that means the more money to keep the things that we have running and going. And that leads to feeling insecure because our luxuries become necessities and we need more to keep them going. And with those luxuries becoming necessities, now we feel like we need more to actually be secure. We're trapped. The things that we used to live quite frankly without, now we feel like we must have. A few years ago, my wife and I bought a used van, 2007 Chrysler Town & Country minivan. We love that van. When we bought that van, it was a significant upgrade for us, and we, both my wife and I, were really concerned because it had leather heated seats. And leather heated seats in this climate, in this environment, is wonderful. But we knew once we went there, this luxury, this thing that we've done our whole lives without, is going to start to feel like a necessity, something we can't live without. So I have a truck without it. But then at days when it gets really cold, I'd choose my wife's minivan over taking my Trailblazer. It just happens. Well, it doesn't just happen. That's what happens. And we need to be on guard against it. That's the snare. That's the trap. And it fights against generosity because we think the more that we have, the more that we need to be able to keep the standard of living that we have. And the luxuries that we now feel are necessities keep us from generosity because we have to fuel them. We have to fund them. And we can't take that money away and give it to some other good to help good increase because we're trapped. We're trapped. What are we going after? Paul says that we can actually experience great contentment. He says this in verse 6. We can experience contentment, security, that everything's going to be okay, not dependent on our circumstances. We can experience, verse 6, contentment with food and clothing. Verse 8, and be content. Food and clothing, food and covering, the essentials. We can experience contentment with just having the essentials. This word contentment, Paul is actually borrowing from the Stoic philosophers of his day. It's, and the Stoicism of the day, and we still there's still glimpses of it here today. It's somewhat similar to Buddhism. Is that you can face your circumstances, whether they're good or bad, with this determination, with this kind of sufficiency, this type of security. And Paul says, we don't get it from money. We don't get it from money. That's letting our circumstances define us, whether or not we have enough. Instead of experiencing some kind of inner strength and the security that God provides, we look to our circumstances and especially money to give us that inner strength. And it won't do it. You know that we can actually have contentment with a lot less than what we think we can. One of the things that, I've told this story before, but one of the things I was told multiple times by people who have gone to India and back, when my older son and I, Levi, were planning to go to India, they say, this is what you're going to be shocked by. You're going to be shocked by people who have so little, food and clothing, that's all. Funded in good measure from your generosity and others. are so happy. They have so little, but they're so happy. Life is still hard, but they're so happy. It's amazing. Their hope isn't in riches. They don't have any. They hope in God, and God provides. The other way in which we falsely or wrongly use wealth is to form and shape our identity. Paul says in verse 17 that those who are rich in this present age should not be haughty. Now that's an interesting thing. Don't be haughty. Well, what does haughty mean? Haughty is another word that means pride, but it's a specific word. It means to cherish high thoughts, to cherish high thoughts about ourselves. See, Paul knows something about our hearts, is that when we are rich, we tend to think that we're successful in everything. It's easy for us to base our self-worth on our wealth. Notice even how we talk about it today. Well, their net worth is such and such. It's very easy for our hearts to take net worth to say, I'm a valuable, worthy person. And being successful in one area of life, making and creating wealth, tempts us to believe that we are successful in all areas of life. We have to keep the wealth growing, though, to keep up with others who are more successful than we are. Money becomes our hope for identity. I am somebody because of my bank account and what I have and what I own. But this is a trap as well. Massive trap. During the financial downturn of 2008-2009, a man named Bill had lost a great deal of money. And he reflects this way. He says, At one time, he could only feel like a person of worth and value if he was making money. And he said, if this economic downturn had happened more than 3 years ago, I don't know how I could have faced it, how I could have even kept going. I would have hated myself. It would have driven me back to the bottle and maybe even suicide. But he says, in spite of all these losses that I've incurred or that have occurred in my life, today I can honestly tell you I've never been happier in my life. Why? Something happened to Bill. What was the difference? He shifted, trying to build his identity and build his self-worth on his net worth. And he put it all on God. God made him worthy. Not his money. Andreas Kostenberger writes this, "The riches so eagerly sought leave those who have acquired them in desperate frustration and anguish, neither satisfying their greed nor healing their hearts." What we try to do with wealth is we try to heal our hearts, and it doesn't do it. It's a trap. We try to find a security and our significance in it. And our hearts are made for security and significance. They are made for those things. But money can't deliver it. It's not designed to do that. The call is to turn our hearts away from this thing, this good thing that God made for us and gave to us for our enjoyment, to turn our hearts away from this good thing and making it too much in our lives and to the one who actually provides all things for us. We're made not for money. We're made for a rich provider. Paul says in verse 17, don't hope in the uncertainty of wealth, but in God who richly provides. God who richly, do you think of God that way? A generous, rich provider? Hope, again, is this strong expectation that deep desires in our hearts are going to be fulfilled someday. That's what hope is, a strong expectation of deep desires in our hearts that are going to be fulfilled. And we have strong desires in our hearts for security and for significance, but money won't fulfill those. We can only get those fulfilled, actually, in God himself. So Paul says to put our hope on a God who richly provides for us. See, we're made for a secure relationship with God himself, and we're made to live in a secure world. We're actually made for that. We're not made for the world that we have right now. We're made for a world where we are secure and where we know that we are loved and significant and that nothing can take those most important things, those essentials, away from us. But we've actually lost that secure relationship and we've lost the world that we were made for. And God, though God provides all things for our enjoyment, we have in some way or another turned to money or wealth to give us some kind of ultimate security and some kind of significance. And the Bible says that when we do that, we are idolaters. We're taking something created and we're making it God. That's what Paul's calling us to turn away from. And because we've all done this in some way or another, we're idolaters and we don't deserve a relationship with God that is secure and perfect. And we don't deserve the heaven that God has created for us and is keeping for us in the day that Jesus returns. We don't deserve it because of our relationship with money, because of our idolatry with money. Our relationship with God is bankrupt. And we owe a debt to God that is infinitely bigger than the U.S. debt. And we can't pay it. We can't pay it. Now, I mentioned earlier in this talk that all the key figures in the Old Testament were rich. You would expect if all the key figures in the Old Testament were rich, that Jesus would be rich. But he wasn't. He was poor. The greatest figure in the whole Bible was not wealthy. He was poor. He was born into a lower middle class family. Blue collar worker, craftsman in the trades. He was so poor that he and his family couldn't afford a tomb to be buried in. He had to be buried in somebody else's tomb, Joseph of Arimathea. Why was Jesus poor? Why was he poor? Well, because Jesus spent himself to pay for our debt. The Bible talks about how Jesus was rich in wealth and dignity and honor and significance. He became poor. He became poor for us. So we could be secure in our relationship with God. So we could have a forever home, his resurrection secured for us, that we too will be raised from the dead when he returns. When he returns, he will make all things new. He became poor and he endured shame. He became a nobody to make us a somebody. He became a nobody. He died naked, stripped of all dignity, so that you and I could be worthy of a new heavens and new earth. Amen. We get treated by God as royal guests. We're given an inheritance that we don't deserve, that somebody else earned for us. It's generosity. We get Jesus' worth. Now, when we see that Jesus, who was rich, became poor to lift me out of my spiritual poverty and relationship with God, to satisfy those real desires in my heart for security and for significance, Jesus did that. He paid my debt of sin. He becomes our hope. Money, it's a good thing. But it's just money. It's just money. We can do a lot of good with it. We can enjoy a lot of things with it, but it's just money. It's not my hope anymore. And then we can seek to do for others as much good as we possibly can do in light of the God who is generous, who provides his son for us to pay for our debt, in light of Jesus who became poor to make us rich. We can do the same thing. We can do the same thing. I invite the worship team up here. We're going to pray. Would you please stand? God, I ask. First, actually, God, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your glad generosity. There's no obligation in you to be generous with us. You do it out of joy, out of your delight, out of who you are. You are a glad, happy, giving, generous God. Everything that we have is a gift from you. It's all because of you. There's nothing that we have done ultimately to earn the things that we have. It's all a gift. Would you please let that sink into our hearts? That our whole basis for life, everything is based in grace. And God, I ask that you would please turn our hearts to you in such a way that we would not at all put our trust in riches and put our trust in wealth, that we would live for something bigger. We would live to do as much good as we possibly can do while also enjoying the good gifts that you've given to us. Why, God? Because you are our hope. Would you give us a vision of you? A vision of your goodness, a vision of your kindness, a vision of your generosity, and would you please change our hearts with a vision of you that we would give ourselves for one another. We'd be as generous and do as much good as we possibly can do until one day we see you face to face and we hear, well done, good and faithful servant. Amen.